Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host Tom Coyne, as always. And today we've got special guest John Fiore. You guys might know him from his preview album that he released back in the early 1980s. We're going to talk about that. He had a couple solo albums. He's even gotten into an acting career over the last few years. So we're going to touch on all that tonight. And as you can see up in the top corner, we've got an honorary Jersey guy, Mr. J.J. Flynn, joining us from Singapore. So J.J. is a friend of the podcast and a friend of Tom's for a long time. So welcome to the show, John and J.J. Hey,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. So John, the three guys you're sharing a screen with tonight, we're all big fans of that debut, that first preview album that came out back in 1983. It's kind of like a cult classic album, right? Everybody that's into the AOR music of the 80s, you know, should know that album. If they don't, you know, it's definitely a good one. But I'm going to kind of hand it off to JJ because we were talking a little before you came on and joined us. And he had a lot of good questions about some of the early stuff in the early days of preview. So, JJ, you want to take it away?
Sure. Thank you very much. Hi, John. So I'll start off with one thing I've been really interested in for years. So your track you wrote with Alan Pasqua, and he came on board and wrote, what, three or four tracks on the album. How did that arise?
You know, the old get on a song thing, you know how that works.
Yeah.
It was an interesting story. So obviously Danny and Ernie Gold, the two brothers, Ernie wrote most of the songs, and together they, you know, produced them. So when we put this whole thing together, which is a great story anyway, so I'll just try and answer your questions. Otherwise, I can just go on and on and on. That's, you know, it's probably the Italian in me. You know?
Yep.
So, Keith was saying, you know, as we're recording, he goes, how come you didn't write, you know, any of the songs? I go, well, look, this was their thing. I do write. I have some stuff. He goes, play me some stuff. So this is during the actual recording of the album. And so I played him, It's Over. And I pretty much had it written. It was written pretty much. I didn't have a bridge in it. And that's where Alan Pasqua got involved, and which I don't care. I'm for zero from zero is nothing. You know, I'm for making great music and having fun, right?
Yeah.
So that's how that got on. And believe it or not, those guys were pissed off that record was on the record. Can you believe that?
So Alan came on the scene. Was he actually an in-house writer at Geffen at the time?
No, so Alan was one of these studio cats that Keith Olsen used.
Right.
So you guys know that he used a lot of the studio cats on the record.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Which irritated, a lot of the guys, And I see their point. I understand, but that's how Keith worked. They picked him. You live and die with, that's what you do. So
did Ernie have a problem with that?
Well, I'm sure you know, Alan actually, I think, co-wrote All Night, which was supposedly going to be the first single.
Yeah.
And he was brought in on that to write a bridge with Chaz Sanford, I think, jumped on that too, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, Chaz was another guy that was part of the whole corral of Keith Olsen. You know, he had all those guys, which, hey, they were great. I mean, you know, Mr. Mister. Those guys were singing backgrounds with me. You know, they weren't Mr. Mister, but they were.
You know, that's Martin Page and everyone. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty cool. You know. Yeah. So that's how that happened. And obviously they were, you know, they weren't happy about it, but you know, it was.
I remember there was a promo single of All Night, wasn't there? Because that was going to be the 7-inch, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was going to be, I think, the initial single. That's what I think signed, you know, got assigned pretty much that, you know, that style. But I guess when they heard some of the other ones, Red Lights and something like that, maybe they thought, you know, maybe more heavier. And then you know how music changes. You know, they sign us 2 years. The record comes out, I think, two years later.
Yeah.
You know, music changes. I think Def Leppard was starting to you know, to be the band or whatever. I forget what sound.
Paramania was coming out. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was another producer that we were looking to, you know, to entertain because, you know, I mean, he was his sound.
Mutt Lang. Mutt Lang. Yeah.
But there was a bunch of different guys. Even John Boylan was thrown around too and stuff like that. Who I happened to meet John Boylan about 2-3 months ago.
wow.
He's out here working with a friend of mine, an actor friend, a guy named James Keach, who's an actor.
Oh, yeah. James Keach.
He's made movies. Yeah. So James and John are partners on a movie they're trying to do about Linda Ronstadt, which Boylan manages. So, you know, it's a small world, man.
Wow.
As long as you keep moving forward, man, you know, you get to enjoy lots of different things. You know?
Right.
I'm a big movie buff as well. So we won't get into the movie.
We're probably going to have to do part Jersey Guys with John, part one, part two.
Maybe three. Potentially even a part three.
Be continued.
Yeah.
Right. Well, John, I wanted to ask you, you talked about the early album and how it kind of changed because, you know, Keith Olsen brought in different players on the album and everything like that. I had read something that the earlier preview stuff when you guys were demoing songs back in New York and stuff, it was kind of a heavier sound, right?
It was. It was definitely heavier when we were playing, you know, some of the New York clubs and stuff like that and playing some shows here and there. It was definitely heavier. Yeah, it was, you know, we were definitely a rock group. It was great, you know. I hate to go backwards and say why it didn't or did not work. There's so many reasons why things do in life work or not work, you know. But I think that was probably one of the, you know, the reasons the sound was a little softer. Because then they wanted David Tharna to remix it. They spent some more money on David Tharna, you know, to try and remix it because I think they wanted a more raw, maybe a more rockin' sound. So they did try and spend more money. So it wasn't, you know, I'm sure you guys have read some of the stuff too, the Keith Olsen interviews and
things.
I mean, I've done a bunch of stuff like that, you know.
There must have been a lot of money spent on the album. The budget must have been huge.
You know what, to be honest with you, I don't know exactly what the number was, but I know it was huge. And I know there were deals coming at us. And because I did co-write a song, I was part of something. But these guys never wanted to do any publishing. They never wanted to, meaning, you know, I mean, if they watch this, you know, I'm not making things up. But, you know, they weren't, for whatever reason, that's their reason, right? You know, everybody has their own reason, but they didn't want to do publishing deals, and there was some good money being thrown at us. And sometimes I think that maybe that had something to do with the, you know, the label and the distribution, which was Warner, to get behind us, because where's their interest? They're going to put, you know, $1 million plus in, you know, into a group to break them videos. Yeah. I mean, we didn't have a video. We were done. When I knew that was MTV era, right?
Sure.
When we didn't have a video. I knew it. We were shot, you know, just, it just wasn't going to happen. And don't forget, we had 5 labels bidding on us. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
I mean, they were literally bidding on us. We were like, you know, we felt we had it. We had the goods. When we would entertain live, the people liked us. And we were just beginning, man. It was, God knows what we could have done. You know what I'm saying? Who knows? You know, nobody knows. But.
So if you started out as a rock musician, right, that you were looking to play, I'm assuming, like, not hard rock, but rock with a little kick to it. This album kind of was like, which now regarded as an AOR classic. I don't even think the term AOR was really thrown around that much. It kind of came out of that West Coast, what we call yacht rock sound of 79,
exactly.
80. Right. Yeah. Were you looking to go in that direction, or they kind of softened it and pulled you into this more?
So when we started, when we got together, do you know how I met the Golds? Does it matter? Or, I mean, I'll just answer your questions. I mean, I have stories.
So. No.
But anyway, so I met the Golds through a newspaper ad.
Mm. Okay, that
so
I did
think that was written. Okay, so so when we started, we were all on the same path. I mean, I was singing, you know, for a long time, doing other things. I wasn't doing records. So I, here's really the story was, is that I was showcasing. So I started guitar at 11 years old, right? I played guitar and, you know, growing up, and music was a hobby to me. It wasn't something I planned on doing. I was in my first year of college, Staten Island Community College. You know,
there you go.
and my girlfriend at the time, we went to the Playboy Club in New York City. We were on a thing, and I would be in bands growing up, you know, playing, you know, hey, with a monkey, you know, all the songs out in the 70s, whatever, you know. Wait, 60s.
60s. Yeah. Monkey yeah, 60s. Came on in 66.
I was born in 55, so you're talking about, yeah.
I was 11. Born in 58, so.
There you go.
The Monkees came out in 66. I was 7 years old when the show came on.
So whatever was popular then, you know, we were doing it. But so the point I was trying to make is, I'm at the Playboy Club, and this cabaret artist, I'll never forget her name, Vivian Reed, she was on Broadway. She comes over to me with the microphone and, you know, at the show. And I start singing, yeah, you know, whatever it was. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And people started applauding. That's what did it to me. There was some energy in that room that I never felt before. And so I went back to my sister's house in Staten Island, in not Gray Hills, but I think she was in Cottonville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little further south.
Yeah, it's a little further. And her husband at the time, you know, said, how do you get started in this business? You know, because we don't, you know, we didn't know anything about, you know, all these things today, these outlets and stuff like that. And they go, well, there's some newspapers called Backstage and Show Business. I said, really? So I started looking at them. And that's how I really got started. I started doing talent contests in Brooklyn. There was not much in Staten Island. But although I did do shows in Staten Island eventually, but Brooklyn, Queens, New York City was the place. So getting back to your question, because I don't want to just keep going, I used to showcase at a couple of different places. One was Alan Dix. I did a little bit at the, what was the other one? The one where Pat Benatar used to showcase, where she met her manager, Rick Newman's place. Catch a Rising Star.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But I didn't really meet her there. I met her at this place, Alan Dix. She had orange hair. She looked totally different. She was classically trained. And she and I were regulars. We would get up and sing a song. And, you know, back then she was, you know, whatever she was singing. And it wasn't rock, trust me. She was classically trained and all that stuff. Then the same with me. I was singing pop or whatever it was. You know, I was starting to put an act together and stuff. And then flash forward, you know, years later, I'm doing, you know, Catskill Mountains, singing, you know, Limey, I'm singing everything, you know, just to work. I love to sing. I have a career going. I got, as soon as that lady grabbed me from that cabaret show, I was off. I was done. I was like, you know, I
that
just
adrenaline rush stayed with you.
Yeah, I was on the journey and I was obsessed, and I was going to take pre-law. I was starting to take law courses in college, and then I was done. But years later, I see Pat Benatar. You know, I hear this song on the radio. She's jet black hair, and you're heartbreaker, dream maker. You know, but I go, holy shit! And that's where the thing in my head just clicked and said, I've always, you know, I was writing music and stuff, but not seriously. I'd write some stuff. I heard music in my head and lyric and stuff. That's when I knew I had to get into an original band and write my own stuff. That's when I knew it, because I wasn't going anywhere in the Catskills looking like Frank Sinatra or something. Right.
And Pat Benatar, you guys preview played with on or toured with.
How
Pat
about
Benatar,
that?
Right?
Eventually, so from the inspiration, we opened up for her for three months. Well, I think that's what you're related to. And then we had the same producer. We had Keith Olsen So you know, interesting. And but that's how that all happened. Now, when I met the Golds, that's not the music we were doing. We were doing, you know, because don't forget, you got to go backwards. it was more the punk era, the punk era at that time, and we were doing more of that kind of music.
Late 70s.
Like the Ramones kind of thing, you know, influences on that kind of music. But again, stuff that they wrote. So I was looking for them. They were looking for me. They were two guys, producers, that wanted to get a record deal and, you know, and make records. And that's what I wanted. So when I found these guys in backstage, that's how I did it. They were in Long Island, and we worked hard, and we just kept persevering, and the sound kept changing, and then, you know, it just evolved into where we were, you know. And then we added the drummer, we added the bass player. Well, the bass player was a local guy that they knew, Skip Parker, and Eddie Bettinelli came in later. There was another guy before that, so... And I still keep in touch with Eddie from here, you know, from here and there. So
was the original thought process of the band to be hotter than this? Like, it doesn't sound like you were really going for like a West Coast AOR classic album.
No.
Right.
No.
So how did it turn out to be?
I think it turned out it was all about the songs. I think it was more about, we set out to write hit songs, right? Or, you know, I think that's what, I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, Ernie wrote some great songs. And the two brothers, you know, the production, the demos, they had everything at their house, they had the studio and all that stuff. So we did everything there. I think that's what it was. I just think it was Ernie, he kept evolving. And my voice kept evolving in the direction. I mean, I could sing anything. So back those, you know, in those days, I probably couldn't sing, you know, like the harder stuff. But, you know, I was basically that type of Foreigner meets Journey meets, you know, Boston meets, which how they, I think that Loverboy, I think that's how they described us. I think some of the things, you know, Whitesnake, you know, that kind of things, which was another Keith Olsen record. You know.
That's right.
Could I just say, I did read, John, that when John Cologna came to see you live, you were a heavier band. And one of the times he was in the studio, he was quite shocked that you'd actually calmed everything down.
Yeah, but it wasn't us. It was Keith Olsen.
Right.
You know,
right.
It was the record label. I remember going into, you know, there were issues, you know, as we were doing the record. I told you that a lot of these guys didn't play on the record, which is not new news, you know, that he used studio cats. And the guys were upset, and needless so, right? You know, Danny, you know, those guys can play, but that was Keith. And we were in the office with David Geffen. I remember, you know, being called in. I mean, I didn't mind, you know, because I wanted, you know, we want a career. You know, let's get going. Let's have hit songs. You know, let's get out there. Let's perform. And there's always a second record and then hopefully a third and, you know, and you evolve as a band. But David Geffen said, they weren't happy. And David said, you guys, let Keith do whatever he wants. We'll make you stars. I'll never forget that. It's stuck in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't the one that was upset over it, you know, because I wanted a career, you know.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, I had visions down, you know, who knows what happens. You know, a lot of bands don't stay together too long. You never know, you know.
No. And you were saying about 5 or 6 majors after you. I know Epic was one, wasn't it?
Right, we had Epic, Chrysalis, Sony.
So were they all offering the same deal? Was it a one album deal?
Pretty much. You know, they're all the same as far as one with a second option. You know, everything's in their court. You know that. Everything's in their, you know, hands. You know, if you do well on the first one, you're going to get a second one, you know.
Yeah.
But, if, you know, if not, and it just depends if they hang on to you. Like, you know, the Whitesnake thing I was remembering, he didn't do well at the beginning, but they stuck with him.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't stick with us. There was talk about doing a second album and it, you know, it never happened. So,
so those demos that have been done, I think I've got 4 or 5 of them. Were they specifically for the second album or are they just going to be shopping around?
It depends what demos you have. I don't know what songs you're talking about, but
yeah, I can't remember offhand the actual. They're not very good quality. They're okay, but they're not mastered.
I have a whole CD of them. Like it's probably if I should have pulled it out.
Yeah. Oh well, you should give them to Dave then over.
I'll give them to no one. I'll give them to you, but don't give them to him.
Yeah, so
Tom sent them to me, and on the email, it's first thing it said wasn't "Hi JJ, how you doing?" The first thing was "Do not share this."
Yeah. Oh, okay. There you go.
I'm very anal with my stuff.
Yeah. What are people going to sue over anyway? I mean, what are you going to get, a penny or something?
You know? You have to know CD collectors and demo collectors.
Die with these, you know, with this music?
It's just the idea of that I have something that you don't have. That is worth more than $1 million to say I have it, you don't, and I'm not giving it to you.
I mean, I was in Japan years ago and, you know, we're going through, we find a record store out there, the Axel Vinyl store where they sell records. And I go looking in, I see the Best of Fiori, you know, I go, what, where did this come from?
They did put out a best of those two albums. Yeah. You didn't even know it?
Yeah. The ones I did with Harry Hess. Yeah. And,
So you didn't even know they put that out?
I never knew, you know, it's crazy.
I always thought it was weird because it was only two albums. Usually you think of a best of like somebody has 10 albums out. Yeah. Well,
someone figured, you know, we can get another, if we can put two together and get another.
Right. Yeah. Exactly right.
So. Crazy.
So just finishing up on my last thought, like 84 was kind of in the US, like a weird time for this music, because I always look at like the vintage AOR West Coast sound was like 79 to about 83. A lot of those albums, I-10, they all came out around that time. 84 was when a lot of the European metal started to become big in the States. The Scorpions, Priest, Maiden. And then the Bon Jovi, the hair explosion was just a year or so after that, early 86.
Right. We missed that.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. It kind of like came out at a weird time, this album.
Exactly. I think the timing was, I think the record took a little longer than it should have, too. Don't forget, it was almost 2 years after we started recording it. We should have had that record recorded in less than a year. I mean, there's no reason for a record to take 2 years, you know, and that's when things change, sound changes. So it's like everything else, timing, you know, like you said, music changes, music comes out. And, you know, everybody, you know, they're in business to make money, you know, whether or not they believe in you or not. And I also think it was, they just didn't want to be hassled maybe by all the internal turbulence that I said was going on.
Right.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, it's hard to analyze the whole thing.
So back in that era, the producers really, I mean, we've had so many other guests on, the producers packed a lot of weight, those named producers.
Of course, it was, you know, again, Keith Olsen was the guy in charge. You know, he was the guy in charge. I mean, God rest his soul, he's not, you know, longer living. But,
So,
you know, I would never speak ill about anybody, you know. But, he was great to work. It was great. You know, it was something new to me. There were a lot of drugs going around during the recording, you know, not on our end, on, you know, the producers, the engineers, and the whole bit. You know, that was their thing. So whether or not that had any bearing, I don't know. I mean, you know, the Beatles wrote hit songs on it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, on everything.
Yeah.
So who the fuck knows what that means?
Right, yeah.
So, I you know, we were in the Let Keith, you know, it was new for me too. So I was learning, to work with a name, you know, producer that I, you know, respected and, you know, liked the sound. But you're right, Kolodna was the one who found it. He came, we did a showcase in New York City at a place called Trax.
I remember
Trax
that
on 72nd Street, West 72nd Street. So we rented it out during the day, and we had Kolodna saw us, you know, prior to that and liked us. And then he brought Keith Olsen in to see us. And Keith saw us and said we had the songs and we had the front guy. So that's what he told me.
So those songs you played. Yeah, those songs you played when Kolodna came to see you, were they basically the same tracks on the album, or was it a variation?
They were basically that direction that we were in at that time.
That was
when we were getting more commercial as far as that kind of music. You know, that rock, like you say, yacht rock now. Whatever.
Yeah, Because of that era, which I experienced later, there was the preview album and the debut from Aldo Nova, which were very different for that time. Excellent songwriting, good production. Two different stories, of course, between you and his debut. But I was thinking, when the songs were softened, when Colotna came in and said, oh, it's a lot softer, and you were listening to Keith doing all the production and everything, I know you were happy with that, and you were saying Ernie wasn't, because you know basically he'd written all the songs. So the softened sound and Alan Pasqua coming in, was that all the plan, I suppose, to get everything streamlined?
I think more like Alan came in during some of the restructuring of certain songs. One was the All Night, so he wrote a bridge for that. That's all it was. Yeah. It was just restructuring.
Okay.
But I think he played on some of the songs. He might have played on that one. And, you know, there were a bunch of different guys that played on it. And that was the issue. It was more of they were unhappy with, meaning the guys in the band, because they didn't play. You know, they didn't play on the record. Keith had his guys.
How was the atmosphere in the studio when you're singing and you've got some session guys playing their music? It must have been quite depressing.
It's interesting, but, you know, eventually with all these meetings we had, everybody knew, you know, listen, we have to be on the same boat together. We want a career, don't we? Don't we want a career? The record company's in charge, not us, you know. Although I wish we were, you know, when you look back, maybe if we, you know, would have stood up or, you know, who knows, you know, when I watch these old Queen movies, you know, Queen would say, fuck off. I'm doing what I want to do.
Right.
I go, why didn't I do that? You know, so I don't know. It's all, you know, but I got to say it did hurt a long time. Yeah. It did hurt. Yeah. You know, when you want something really, really bad.
Yeah.
In life, I'm dealing with, you know, my daughter who wants something really bad, not in the music business. She wants to get pregnant. It's not happening right away, you know, but you know, it hurts, but that's life, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, anyway. So
was that standard operating procedure that they used guys that played on the album, but it wasn't like the cat wasn't let out of the bag type of thing?
We didn't know that up front. Maybe, and it wasn't that the guys, I think the guys had a chance. The guys did play when they were cutting rhythm tracks. The guys were there. It was that for some reason, maybe because they wanted to get it done faster, I don't know. And maybe they didn't, you know, like Danny would do some play on some of the overdubs, you know, and stuff like that he would play. But I don't think the bass player played one note on it. I could be wrong. Wow. We're going way back, but I don't think he played. The drummer, you know, Eddie got to play some, but he used Mike Baird back then.
Mike Baird, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think he was in Journey for a while, too, or something.
Yes.
He was a studio guy.
He was on that River Dogs album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the guy, what's his name, from Cheap Trick played on my song, you know, It's Over.
Who? Nielsen
did?
Yeah.
Really?
Nielsen played the solo.
Wow.
One. Yeah.
Cool.
Listed on it. Yeah. So
because folklore always was that there was like we in the hair band era, which you know we were all big fans of. Mike Slammer played on probably more albums that he wasn't featured on.
Yeah.
You know, and you would hear all these things. Oh, that wasn't this guy. That wasn't that. It was Mike Slammer. Right. But they never let that out of the bag. And I've even seen him on interviews where he kind of doesn't say yes or no.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah. No. You're right. I mean, later on when I got to do sessions in New York City for a long time, I would meet all these guys and say, oh yeah, I played on, that was me playing that solo on this record, that record, this record, okay. That record, this record, you know. Crazy. But, you know, that's what it was. And that's why, like I told you, David Tharna came in later. They tried to remix it. So they were going for a more heavier, you know, sound.
Yeah.
I think that they just, like, Kalanda should have been in there, man, every freaking day. He should have been in there. He stayed away. He should have been in there listening to what was going on.
Because he probably would have beefed it up somewhat with his track record of what he had done.
You know, he's the guru, right.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not saying, you know, that it's his fault or anything, but I'm just saying that's, you know, when you have that and then you have David telling you, let Keith do whatever he wants to do. You know?
But the oddity of it is what's made this album endear for 40 years is that it's a soft AOR album.
Yeah. And it's good. Yeah. The songs are great.
Oh, it's great. It's great. You know, it probably wouldn't have endeared as well if it was heavier. Yeah. Because it's been something like for AOR aficionados like us three, it's always been like, you know, top of the heap.
I mean, not to toot the horn, but when you get emails from people or, you know, letters from people from all over the, you know, from all over the world that, you know, I would get some stuff and they would, the guy, people would say, and this is funny, oh my gosh, you're like, you're unbelievable. You're better than Led Zeppelin. I mean, you know.
But yeah, AOL guys tend to lose their minds.
I'm going, what?
But, Let me have some of what you're smoking.
These are fans. No, I'm talking about people
right.
that like.
No, I'm saying the fans, whatever he was smoking. Yeah.
Whatever they're smoking.
Right, yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. I
mean, wow.
Well, I was reading some article, like some reviews and stuff of that album. And it was like, you know, people are just like, you know, a masterpiece, you know, a classic, you know, not to be questioned, you know, it's like just stuff like that, the cult status of it. So it's pretty amazing that just that one single album, right?
Yeah, it's true.
There's no fillers on the album. It's one of those albums you put on, you play the whole thing and then you upset it's finished. You know, it's a great album.
Yeah, there's a guy that I hooked up with here in L.A., Mark, I'm trying to think his last name. He was in a punk band or something like that. The nicest guy. We keep in touch here and there. His wife just passed away, and he says, oh, my gosh, my wife would listen to your record every day. And I go, you know, this is when you hear this stuff, it's just like, it just, you know, it just gets you, you know, that some people actually found it and liked it. And, you know, it's a beautiful thing. You know,
So how did you ever get involved with the Harum Scarum guy, Harry and Pete Lesperus and Darren Smith? And
yes. So that was done through MTM Records, the Swedish, Swedish label, Magnus. Somehow he contacted me and told me this guy, Harry Hessen in Canada.
Toronto
was interested in producing you. So I said, well, great, let's do it, you know. And that happened after I had a solo deal with Atlantic. You knew about that too, right?
Well, that's what I was going to talk about, because I know JJ and I were talking about this earlier before we went on. We want to go backtrack a little bit to that mid-90s period there.
So that's how I met Harry Hess. And that was a phenomenal experience. I mean, Harry Hess, so talented. The band, amazing. Just great stuff. And again, he had the songs written. It was basically, from what I understand, it was a Harum Scarum record, you know, without Harry singing, right? I mean, you guys would know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it had like the sound. Right? It had their sound to a T.
Yeah. And, oh, my gosh, it was so much fun. It was so quick. Harry's great. We still keep in touch from here to there, you know.
They had a real signature. There were so few bands of that era that had a signature sound. They were one of them. They had a real signature sound.
They were heavy, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, no, they were. They were. But they had like a real unique sound.
Yeah. I mean, God, I listened to some of that stuff and some of it had overtones of, you know, the Def Leppard vocals, you know, on first one I did with him, Today to Tomorrow and stuff like that. So that was, so he, you know, wrote all that stuff. He had it written. So it was easy, quick. The second record we did, which was Body Electric, we co-wrote everything together. So... which was great. So we both did lyrics, we both did this, that, music, titles. And so that was another experience. It was great. Again, we did that for, I think the first one was done for, it was mainly done for, Sweden and Zero Corporation.
Zero, yeah, I have them here. The Japanese copies came out on Zero, yeah.
There you go. And that was supposed to be a big thing, and then all of a sudden, I think Zero went like bankrupt.
They went bankrupt very shortly, like after these. This might have been, if not the last.
It might have been the last deal. I know. Yeah. I know. I mean, crazy. There was talk about us coming over there, doing shows, you know, and all that stuff. Oh, God, I couldn't wait.
And Zero, I don't know whether you know this or not, like from when grunge hit in the States big, a lot of the big bands from the States got signed to Zero. They had like a big catalog. They had become like almost like a major label in Japan.
Yeah.
And they had like from like 92 to 96, 97. And then there were a lot of other small Japanese labels that were popping up. I think that was stealing Alpha Brunette and a whole bunch of them. And they ended up folding.
Supposedly we were, I think that those records were released in like 18 countries or something like that.
They had big distribution. Yeah. Very big.
You know, that was that. Another one.
it's all part of this music, really. I mean, every guest we have on, it's kind of the same thing, you know.
Listen, I know these stories are a lot. They're similar in many ways. It's in like anything we do, you know. I mean, I could go with, you know, the acting thing is another one, you know, that whole thing. But, you know, people break out, you know. It happens, you know.
You know, people that weren't part of the scene, I mean, I go back to the 60s like you do. A lot of younger people think that this music was like always endearing and they don't realize all the pitfalls and, you know, how dead rock was in the States and in the late 70s and with the punk and the disco and, you know, like, and they just think that there was always like this great wave of rock music and everybody, you know, and I talk about it all the time. There's so many bands that in other parts of the country would be big and then you'd see them play New York in the cat club in the city. And there's 50 people there.
Exactly.
And they're signed to a major label. So, like, you know, like a lot of people that didn't live the scene think it's a lot more glorious than what it was.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the record's supposedly out. And we're doing, you know, some radio shows up in the Catskills and some other stuff up, in the upper New York State. And the record, we're doing a show and this and that. The record's not even in the record stores, you know. It was like, there was just no promotion, nothing. Right. Whether or not they were trying to see if it would hit, they played it on a couple of stations. It takes more than that. You got to get it to a couple of major stations.
Oh, absolutely.
And then let the people decide, you know. But that, you know, but that's that. We should do a documentary. That would be great, a music doc, because I haven't seen anything like that. Well, to get all the other docs about certain bands and this and that, blah 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 blah.
Want to get it off the ground? That could help you out. I've lived through all the eras. I mean,
well, you guys know because you interview a lot of people, so you know so many of these stories. You know?
Oh, everybody's got a story. Yeah,
yeah. I have a really close friend of mine who became over the years, and we opened up for his band back then. So it's great to meet these guys at later in life. The Tubes, remember the Tubes?
Sure. Of course.
Yeah.
What's his name? What's the lead?
Faye Weibel.
And Prairie Prince was in that band.
So Faye and his wife live like just, you know, up the street from where I am in LA. So we became friendly over the, you know, last probably about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years. So he, you know, the stories that that he tells me about his thing, you know, they were lucky to get David Foster on their stuff. So that was a big thing with him later on, you know. They had their thing, they had their sound and whatnot. But then when Foster came in, that really gave him that album, you know, the Talk to You Later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the album that broke them on the radio, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, they just did a 75th anniversary. I wasn't in town for it, but I went at the Hollywood Bowl, and it was for David Foster's 75th birthday, and and the Tubes played, I think, one of those songs.
Really?
To see it. That, yeah. Anybody who Foster was, you know, producing over his years, you know, Celebration, I think. Bocelli was there, you know.
So I know JJ wants to talk to you a little bit about film.
Yes.
And
Before I go on to that, I was going to say, the 93, was it Atlantic deal you had?
96,
was it? Okay. What was that going to be then? What kind of music?
Okay, great. So great story. You know how I got that deal? So I'm in New York City, and I'm doing sessions. I'm a session singer, right? Singing commercials, jingles, all kinds of stuff. So I'm getting a phone put in my car, telephone. You know, back then, 80. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like
big block.
Yeah. So I go to this place, and the guy who owns the place up on 10th Avenue up there, you know, he knows me. He knew Will Lee, the bass player, and all that stuff, you know, who's always involved in music. So he goes, oh, you know who's coming in later? I go, no, who? He goes, Jason Flom from Atlantic. I go, I don't know, because I'm out of the record business. I don't know, you know, much. And pretty much. And he goes, yeah, Jason. I go, oh, great. So I end up coming back to pick up my car, and my friend asked me, play something. And I'm playing him a demo that I co-wrote with my friend Jed Lieber, who's out here in California. And so we wrote this song. I mean, I wrote it pretty much. Then I called Jed up over the phone. He was in L.A. I was in New York. We finished it, blah, blah, blah. And this other kid demoed it for me in New York. And so we were doing demos because I want to get another deal. I was, you know. Anyway, long story short, he's playing it, and in walks Jason Flom. So the guy goes, oh, what's that? And my friend goes, that's him. He goes, that's you? He goes, sounds great. That's a hit. I know. He goes, can I take it? I go, no. He goes, would you come in for a meeting? I go, sure. And that's how that started. And it evolved. It took a couple of months. I remember seeing Doug Morris, who was running the label at the time. And don't forget, I was in my late 30s, I think. I was, you know, 96, whatever that was. And I was almost, late 30s, maybe even early 40s. Yeah. Anyway, so I remember Doug looking at me. I see him looking at my sideburns because they were gray, you know, a little gray. See his eyes go to my sideburns, and I was like, oh boy, this is not going to. But anyway, I think he threw a snowball at Jason. And so Jason went into a, you know, like, oh, maybe this guy's a little old. But when Jason found me, he goes, that's what I'm looking for. A Michael Bolton meets Garth Brooks meets this. You know, that's what he said. You know, this is how weird this business is that people, you know, at that given moment. Right. And so eventually, blah, 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 he kept toying with himself. But we got the deal. And then the problem was, is unlike Preview, we had all the songs. Right. We had all the songs demoed. You could play them with this. Yeah. We only had a couple songs that I co-wrote, or wrote. So then we're chasing songs. Then we're Jason sending me stuff. Listen to this. You know, you got all those the major hit songwriters sending me their C records. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know,
the songs they're never going to use.
Exactly. You know, unless David Foster, you get somebody like him involved. Right. So what's his name? Jason reaches out to, I think, somebody who co-wrote Andy, what's his name? He co-wrote some of the songs on Bolton's records, the big songs like Soul Provider.
Andy
Goldmark. Andy Goldmark. Or Gold something. Yeah.
So he's Goldmark, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Goldmark. Yeah. So he reaches out to me. He goes, hey, listen, we should write a song with Linda Thompson, who's David Foster's wife at the time, in Malibu. So don't forget, I was living in New York, so they flew me out here for a couple of months to stay out here. And so we're writing stuff with Linda. Linda loved me. And she says, oh, I got to play. David's going to love you, blah, blah, blah. You know, and he's big with Warner and that and stuff like that. And so that's what Jason was trying to get. He goes, if we can get, Foster involved, we got a shot. Otherwise, they gave me some other guy who we did some stuff, who did like old Michael Jackson stuff. But it wasn't. You know, I think he was more of a musician. I'm trying to think of his name. But the other guy was the famous R&B producer over at Atlantic. Who's the guy that did all those records for so long? Remember his name? Turkish?
90s?
Yeah, 80s, 70s, 80s. Big, you know. Anyway, his son got involved. Joe. Sorry, I should have had this stuff written down. And then, so that's what happened. And, you know, eventually the whole thing just evaporated. We were spending money and this and that. And, you know, I remember I ran into George Benson at the hot tub here in LA. He goes, hey man, why don't you use one of my songs? We started talking and stuff like that. And then later on, I end up co-writing a song on one of his records.
Oh, wow.
Years later, which was cool. Pretty great. Yeah. I got three co-writes on one of his albums, you know, cool album. So, so that's how that 96 thing came. And what also happened was Danny, Doug Morris was leaving, or he was being moved up to being president of the whole Universal Group or something. And they were bringing in a guy called Danny Gold, I think, Goldstein maybe. Mm-hmm. And so he was the new president. He didn't last long. So we just got shuffled and we were done, you know, pretty much. So the record never came out. A lot of good demos with Keith Diamond. God rest his soul. We did a couple of really great songs. He would write with me, you know, co-write. I'm trying to think of that R&B writer, but yeah, so it was a great, you know, another great experience, but it didn't happen. You know.
So you're just saying in the middle of that conversation about Bolton, because you guys actually were doing jingles and commercials together, weren't you?
Correct. That's how I met him. He was sort of in a void, you know, going to, and now there's a great story, right? He was doing records for years. I don't think he really broke yet like he did. And, you know, had a couple of things. He was in and out of rock bands. But he started making money when he did commercials. And he got in there because of his manager, Lewis Levin, one of his other singers, Joe Serisano, who was a really great jingle singer or, you know, session singer.
Yeah.
So they got Bolton in there. Bolton, you know, hit it with this jingle writer, Susan Hamilton. She's no longer alive. God bless her. And so, you know, it was like, you get me some stuff. And he had her produce Georgia on his record or co-produce it. So that's how he, you know, came out of that. And he liked my voice. So he invited me in to sing. I'll never forget. I heard those songs by Desmond Childs. Great songs. How can, he takes me into the studio late at night and I hear this demo. How can we be lovers? You know, how can we be lovers? I go, what? This is an amazing song. You know, it's like, crazy.
Wow.
And so I got to sing on that one. And then You Wouldn't Know Love was the other one. And then he produced that. They just put it on Cher's record because he produced two songs on it. So that was a great thing. You know.
Cool. Really cool. Also, I didn't know about which commercials you did back in the day. So I did a bit of research. You did some big companies, didn't you? Really big.
I'm not gonna let him get out of here until he does the Folgers song for us.
Best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup.
There you go. Thank you.
Brilliant. It's Thursday. No, but I was very fortunate.
My favorite was the Slice commercial. It even sounds. Yeah.
We got the juice, new slice. Try it. You know, when I do shows, like there's a club here I do. I used to do it a couple times a year. Now I'm down to like once a year because I get bored with it. It's called the Vibrato Club over here. And so I use the screens, which is great. And I play, you know, I do a whole thing. I play Out on the Edge from the Heavenly Kid, you know.
Yeah, soundtrack.
In fact, I come out like that, like a rock star, you know. And then we transcend back into, you know, the story, my story, which is great. I just, you know, just tell stories about, you know, these songs, how they, you know, people in my life. But anyway, we get to the commercials and people seem to like that. It's a good thing.
I mean, the commercials you actually see on YouTube and with your voiceover, the Atari one, these ones, they're real classic commercials. You know what
Atari,
I mean?
I know. Yeah. Well, you know deep down that it's going to be a hummer. Nobody's hotter than Atari this summer. No. I don't know if that's the key, but that's pretty hot.
Sounds great. Oh,
man. Does this mic sound good? I'm curious.
Very good. Very good. Lucky we're recording it.
We did so many of them, you know, all the Cokes, all the Slice. I mean, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah. Mm.
Another thing I was going to say after this, as I mentioned, the Heavenly Kid. So did that come about because you were friends with some of the production people, or did you just put a song in there and they took it?
Another great story. I got lots of stuff. So working with Steve Ferroni, right? The session drummer who was in The Average White Band, who we opened up for, preview opened up for them in New Jersey something bowling alley. There was a bowling alley that rock bands played at, the 510 Lane, something Lanes. Yeah, I think it was in Asbury Park area.
I was just going to say
Asbury Park. Fast Lane?
Fast Lane. There you go.
I was right next door to Asbury Lanes, I think.
Oh, okay.
It was, maybe that's the place.
Was it a rock club?
The Fast Lane Well, then the bowling thing eventually turned into a rock club. Yes.
The bowling. Okay. So I think it's the Fast Lane. Okay. And we opened up for the Average White Band. Uh-huh. And then later on in the years, I got to meet Steve. Steve was doing commercials. He was a session drummer. You know, he'd do some of that stuff. And so we got to be friends. He liked my voice and stuff like that over the years. So he calls me one day. I'm in New York. He goes, Fiore, it's Ferroni. I go, oh, what's up? He goes, I'm here with George Duke in L.A. We're in the studio. I go, oh, great. I didn't even know who George Duke was. You know, I go, he goes, we're doing something. He's looking for Steve Perry to do something whatever. So he goes, here, boom. So he puts me on the phone. I go, oh, hi. He goes, yeah, da, 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 da. We start talking. And I didn't know where it was going to lead, but I think I was on a plane within 4 days, 5 days. I was, flown out to L.A. and we did The Heavenly Kid.
Wow.
Which was really, really, really cool. Great song. Randy Goodrum wrote that song.
That is a good song.
And then we were going to do, that's a whole nother story. We were going to do, he wanted to do, because I could sing R&B. I could sing all that stuff. He wanted to do, he heard some other things I did. And he was an R&B producer too. He did Let's Hear It for Boys. He did, not Teddy Pendergrass. Who was the guy? Really great album. Stay With Me Tonight. Anyway. So I remember there was talk about he wanted to do a record with me. And at that time, Doc McGee was like my acting manager, so to speak. We didn't sign anything, but I met him through this other guy. That was the other thing going back with Preview, not to get anything. I think our management sort of didn't help us. We didn't have the power management behind us. Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I'm not saying that is the reason, but that's another thing. You know, you get the right management behind you. Like if we had Doc McGee or somebody like that who was behind us, maybe they would have forced it. You know, they didn't want to put that record out. The manager we had sort of forced it to put it out. Mm. So that's what was going on too. From what the best of my recollection was, they really didn't want to put it on. Hence why they didn't get behind it, no video. Yeah. But anyway, so that's how I met that, and that's how I did The Heavenly Kid. And then Doc said, don't do the R&B record with him. He goes, I got this other guy on Elektra, and we could do something with him. More rock, more stuff like that. And it didn't work out. So
what's your preference? What music do you enjoy the most then?
I still feel like I'm a rocker. I still I still love, rock power, power ballads, power rock, some of the stuff I sing, now when I do the show, I like music and I like, really great songs. So I find stuff that has, meaning to me as far as the lyric goes, what it does to me, and then just liking the melody, it's just stuff like that. But I love rock. I still listen to it, but I listen to everything. And I even sing, in this television show I do, the guy wants me to sing Italian. But I do play in it. I play Tommaso Bellucci from Sicily, guys. So you gotta watch out. which we just got signed for 5 seasons, which I'm excited about. And I don't have a major lead, but I'm recurring role. So the season one, which we thought we were dead, but it lived. And we did this 2 years. We came out in 22. It was on Amazon. It's still on Amazon. And then the pandemic came, which I had a series signed I was going to do with George Lopez out here, Michael Madsen, a whole bunch of really good guys, the guy from The Godfather, I'm trying to think of his Gianni Russo. And then the pandemic came and that, killed everything, obviously killed people, killed the whole thing. And so that, that went away. And then as soon as I get the momentum back again, the strike happened, the SAG-AFTRA strike happened.
Yeah. Well, let's backtrack a little bit, John, because how long have you been acting and how did you get into that?
Okay, so that's about 5 years ago, and I did it out of, you know, I used to do, like, back in the days in the 80s, I did some off-Broadway musical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did a show called Leader of the Pack that went to Broadway. It didn't go with me. It was a bunch of guys, like Paul Schaefer was in it. He played Phil Spector. Mm. So it was about the story of the producer writers of all those songs, Leader of the Pack, Going to the Chapel, anything back from that era that Ellie Greenwich wrote, Ellie Greenwich and her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wrote River Deep, Mountain High, stuff like that. I was lucky enough to sing that song, which I still do today in my show sometimes. I got to sing that song on every night at the Bottom Line. Remember the Bottom Line?
Oh, sure.
Great rock club. So yep. We did that show in the 80s and standing room only for like several months. I mean, so many people came to see it. People came, they were offering me some acting gigs out here in LA, but nothing definite. You know, it was like, oh, come out to LA and, you know, maybe, and, you know, I'm working.
Hmm.
And I'm doing, you know, I have a life. I'm doing jingles. I loved it. I was, you know, singing, making money and having a life after all the you know, the times of trying to get to where you get to. And so that was always in the back of my mind. I've always loved acting. Flash forward, do you know any background about my daughter, who she was married to, any of that stuff?
No.
Okay.
No.
So my wife, I'm married 20 years. And if you, I mean, you can find it, but my daughter was married to Charlie Sheen.
Oh.
So when we moved out
that's
here.
Interesting.
Yeah. So yeah. I have two grandchildren. She's my stepdaughter, but she calls me dad. We're like, you know, her dad had passed away when I met her anyway. So, her name's Brooke Mueller. And, So I knew Charlie and, you know, I've always toyed with it, you know, and all that stuff, you know, met his brother. We were close with the family and all that stuff, Emilio and all that stuff. And then when I got divorced, we just sort of went like this. We still keep in touch. Charlie, he's out in Malibu with the kids, stuff like that. And, never helped me as far as an actor. Talked about some things, but never happened. But so it's always in the back of my mind that, you know, I always wanted to try it. So since I'm in the union about 5 years ago, I just started going to seminars around here and to see if I like it. I started liking it. I started taking classes. I started taking improv 1, 2, and 3 of the second city here and just, you know, snowballing to about a year, year and a half. Then finally I got my pictures. Like I knew I was going to have to, you know, like commercials. Work and audition. And that's what happened with jingles. It took me over probably a good year and a half before I got my first spot. And that was from the Alessi brothers. You guys know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Great albums.
Yeah. So Bobby and Billy, I remember I got a call and he goes, hey, you know, you're going to do your first final. I go, really? It was a Soft and Dry commercial. That was the first one that broke me. And then once that went on, it was like, get me that guy. Get me, you know, the same old thing. You know, it's like a, you know, you get a hit and it's like, you know, let's get another hit. And
then, sure.
And that's how it happened. But so that's what happened with the movies. We did, you know, we have some dinner parties here. I have a piano here. I play, but poorly. And, but I'll hire a piano player to play and I'll, you know, get up and sing some songs. So my wife knew Lee Majors, you know, the old time actor.
$6 Million Man.
So he and his wife were here, and that would have been probably four and a half, five years ago, would have been this like sort of December coming up. Yeah, I'd say 4 years ago this December. And I had already taken my classes. I got my pictures ready. I sing. He goes, so what are you doing? You know, with yourself and da, da, da. I go, well, you know, I'm really into acting and da, da. He goes, well, send me your pictures. He's living in Houston. I got an up and coming producer, director who's doing a movie. Maybe you'll get your feet wet. You'll get a line or two, you know, you'll play a DEA agent. It's a drug cartel movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I send him my pictures, the producer, you saw my picture up there before. And it lends itself, I guess, to that kind of genre, which is great, you know. And so that's how it was. He sends me the script and he goes, I want you to do a self-tape. Back then we were doing self-tapes. Put yourself on tape doing Pallone. So I read the script. I go, Pallone? He's like one of the leads in the film. He goes, yeah, you'd be great. He said, you know, you're like a, you know, like the Godfather kind of thing, Brando, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I go, well, That's impressive. So so that's what happened. I did the tape, easy tape, and so I got the role, and that came out. That was the first one that came out. It was on, I don't even think it's on Amazon anymore. I don't know where it is. It's called Narcos Sub.
Right. Yes. 2021.
21? Yeah, 21. And then they re-released it as The Shipment, and they started selling it in like a DVD or whatever.
Ah, okay.
It streamed somewhere. I don't know. But that led me to some other things that I ended up doing and stuff like that. But that's how I got started. And then eventually I got an agent, then I got a manager, and that's it. And, you know, it's not easy.
Yeah.
But it gives me something to do. It really gives me, and that was the reason. The reason was, is I guess I got into singing. Remember the first thing I said to you was, when the person handed me the mic at that club, I heard this, and something happened, the energy between me and the audience. Mm-hmm. And so it's all about, you know, I'm a performer. I like to try and move people. And in this case, I'm telling a story. Yeah. You know, I'm just telling a story. You know, someone writes a script, and my job as an actor is to just tell the story that the writer wrote, you know.
Sure.
And I'm learning more and more. This is what I do. I've Zoomed with guys in London today, you know.
Yeah.
We you know, it's an ongoing process of just to be more and more, to be better at whatever you do, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
So speaking of performing, I read a few years ago when you did the album cover for Preview, the best of the band didn't like you being on the front.
Exactly. That's exactly.
That's a good question. I always thought of that too. It was a band, but there was only one guy that was pictured.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these guys were in the back, right?
Or the back cover.
But why did they cut my head off too? That was something I never understood. It. I did have hair. Trust me, I had a lot more hair then. And
where was that picture shot?
It was shot in downtown LA. It's funny how I can remember these names. Mick Haggerty. Imagine that. I can remember these names.
It was a weird cover, too, because when you first looked at the cover, you weren't really sure what it was. You had to really study it. I say, okay, he's pulling. When you first looked at it, you wouldn't really, right? You didn't really know what the hell it was.
Yeah, so Mick Haggerty was the guy in charge of photography and all that. He was the guy who came up with that concept. And for whatever reason, they were pissed. You know, it's like they were saying, well, why couldn't I be that? And they would say, well, you're not the lead singer.
Yeah, I mean, the singer does get deference over the rest of the band. But this was a lot of deference.
But it was weird. Yeah, it was almost like it's John Fiore, but it says Preview. You know,
right,
it,
right. Yeah,
totally. I thought you were going to say you didn't play on the album.
Exactly. And then, well, you guys know that they somehow somebody released a red lights in red vinyl.
I'd heard about that.
Yeah, someone contacted me and says, hey, I got some of those. I go, really?
But they put this out on red vinyl?
The one song, right? The red lights
one
song.
Oh,
the one song.
Yeah,
okay. That's even stranger.
This was way after the fact. I guess this wasn't something
happened. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think they wanted to do it. That was what they were thinking of doing. But I don't know. Who knows? You know. So.
Good stuff. Anything else, JJ, that you wanted to bring up?
Well, yeah. If we're back on the album again, I was always interested in. I read this article once, and so Cologne come to see you a few times. Was this when you were supporting the big acts, or was this just you on your own in a small club? Because when you were supporting like Earth, Benatar was probably the big one. Was he coming to those shows?
No. We got Pat Benatar after we got the deal, and that was almost like we knew the record. You know, they said they were going to put it out, and we were really pissed. So I think the plan was let's get these guys out on the road. So they gave us the Benatar tour, then Asia. We opened up the Asia, which was phenomenal. And it was, you know, the people loved us. And how many people come to see the opening band? Very few, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, you get one guy in the back, something like that. You know? A few people that show up. But the response was great. You know, we were definitely a good live band. We were good, you know, we would have been great if we could have just kept doing it. So that's how that happened. Kalander and I, we were doing some shows around just to get us, because we wanted the showcase. That was the whole idea, to get a showcase together. We had a plan. Our manager had a plan. You know who got involved with this? You remember an English manager called David Hemmings?
Hemmings.
Hemmings. Hemmings was involved early with this guy Arlo, and So really it was Hemmings that became our manager. We wanted to get Doc, but for some reason, I think Doc was busy with whoever he had at that time. I forget who was.
Bon Jovi. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Bon Jovi came out then. You know, Bon Jovi. But I forget who was out then that they had. I don't know. But anyway, we got this guy David Hemmings, and it wasn't working out. So Arlo took us over. A lot of the guys weren't happy with him, but we knew him. He was like a friend, so to speak. You know.
Yeah.
He ended up working on the Bon Jovi, you know, stuff as far as being like a road manager or, you know, liaison or something like that.
So
it's a miracle that we got that far. I mean, we went through so many different people, you know, trying to find the right management, you know. So
yeah. So I suppose there were no tour shirts printed.
What'd you say?
No tour shirts printed.
No.
No merchandise, right?
No. There wasn't much, put it that way. It's so funny. I got to meet Gene Simmons years ago. You know, he lived here in this big house here in Beverly Hills somewhere. And he took us into his memorabilia room. You talk about, I mean, one huge room full of all KISS stuff.
Anything that had KISS on it, right?
Everything. I mean, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I know Doc manages KISS. We're gonna reconnect because he's he's very close to a friend of mine in Colorado, so we keep talking, not together, but we keep talking about trying to get us together. So I think it's gonna happen. You know,
like, so everything in this memorabilia room that he had was KISS.
Yes,
he's very humble, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, he's KISS.
He's a businessman. Hey, he's got anything you can put the KISS name on. It could be a radio, a coffin, whatever you want.
He is a businessman.
It's a lot of things. Leave it at that.
It must have been a really big room. Really big room.
It was huge.
Yeah.
The house was a mansion. You know, it was one of these, you know.
Well, it better be.
Sure.
But he sold it. He sold it, and he moved. I think he moved somewhere else, smaller.
Yeah. It's only a block long the house now.
Yeah.
So, well, hey, anything else, JJ, before we wrap it up here?
This is fun, guys. We got to revisit this again. This
I know. Yeah.
But we got to do the documentary. You promised.
We are going to work on a documentary. Yes.
Let's do it.
Going to hold you to that.
Yeah. Hey, listen. Maybe we'll have this 20th century record come out again. Who knows?
So. There you go. We'll have to look into that too.
I was just going to end with that, not about preview, but about the demos and stuff you've got. Is there anything in the pipeline then, maybe for some sort of, compilation release?
Well, that's what I'm hoping to do with this guy, Dave. You know, he contacted me with this other guy, trying to think of his partner, Kai. Kai is the other guy.
Yes.
But this guy, Dave's in Vegas. So we talked, and he has a bunch of these. So I have to listen to them. And you know, he's got to go through, contact whoever the writer is. If it's something I wrote, it's a lot easier, or co-wrote. The really good stuff that I can get is the stuff I co-wrote with, not all of them, but I co-wrote a couple, but Jed Lieber. You know who Jed Lieber is, right? So Jed put a band together with me. And he has a recording studio out here, but back in those days... And we were almost signed to Warner Brothers, and we had some great songs. We got really, really good stuff, and songs like they were called was Jane, but it was changed to Shane, and then there was another one, If You Take Me Back, which is a song that I co-wrote, And there's a couple of, there's about four or five of them, and they're rocking, you know, with some nice stuff. So maybe that's what Dave has. And if we can get it together, if I could contact Jed, and, you know, obviously he's got to be okay with it. I mean, I don't know why anybody wouldn't be okay. I mean, what are you talking about? A penny or something? Two pennies?
So what era is this? 80s, 90s?
Yeah, it would be in the 80s, 90s. Yeah, 80s.
Yeah.
Late 80s, 90s. I'm trying to think. I think it was, I think it was after this stuff. Yeah, he saw me at the Bottom Line doing the Leader of the Pack show. Hmm. And he loved my voice. He came backstage. He was working with, I'm going down with Beck. He was working with Jeff Beck, who I loved, man, gosh, what great music. So he was working with Jeff Beck and he was friendly with them. I think he came back with Beck, if I'm not mistaken, or something like that. And
it was on Beck, so Bogut and Apice, that song, right?
Oh yeah.
Going down.
Down, yeah. Down, down, down. Great song. Oh God. So guess who he got Simon Phillips to play drums on it.
Mm. Wow.
So we flew out to London to Simon's house, which is out in the east somewhere in England. And we stayed at his place for a couple of days. We recorded a couple of songs. Simon on the, oh my gosh, the double.
It's tremendous.
I mean, it was great. It was just, you know, we were making music. It was phenomenal. So that's part of the demos. And Simon was, you know, we were hoping to get this deal. It was close, but, you know, again, didn't happen for whatever reason. Hmm. And, but we got those demos, and maybe, if I can, you know, convince Jed, you know, to have these things, you know, but you never know, you know.
Yeah. We'll keep an eye out for that. And
you'll be the first to hear if it happens.
All right. Okay. All right. We'll put it out at the same time the documentary comes out.
Jersey guys.
That's right. Well, the documentary comes out, it'll be like a package deal, right?
There you go.
Yeah.
So, I guess, John, we appreciate these great stories tonight. And it was great. We'll have to do a part two at some point.
Oh, I love it. It's a lot of fun, man. Really. You guys are great.
Thank you.
Every single one of you.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
John.
I appreciate it. You guys. Take care, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks.
JJ, thanks, we'll John. Talk to you soon. Well. John, take care. Bye.
Arrivederci.
Bye.
Oh, yeah. Look out for Surviving the Cartel. That's the one I'm in.
That's the next thing? Okay.
Well, that's the one that I did season one. We just signed five seasons, a total of five.
And what's that going to air on?
It's going to be worldwide on AMC channel.
AMC.
It's on Amazon now.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, but the season one only had five episodes, and I was in episode 3 and 5, I think, or 3 and 4.
I got to look for that. Okay.
I'm in two of them.
Okay.
But going forward, we were supposed to record we do it in Mexico. We were supposed to do it in the end of July, and they had an issue with a visa on one of the guys. So a lot of these guys are from Argentina or Mexico. They all speak Spanish. My role was originally, Tomasco, like this. I'm a Sicilian mafia, you know, entrepreneur guy. You know. So, and I speak Italian in it, and I speak some Spanish and stuff like that. My Spanish is not so good, you know, más o menos. So that's how that developed. And so it's on Amazon now, and they got this together where... AMC is going to distribute it worldwide. So we're happy about that. I'm filming. I got the dates for March of next year.
Okay.
Season two will be on in July. So maybe we'll do a Jersey Guys thing.
Great. That'd be cool.
Very good. I got to look for it.
Awesome. All right.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
John.
Very good. Take care, John. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay, man. Thanks.
Bye-bye, JJ. Take care, Mike.
And you, Joe.
Thank you.